from London, BBC Caribbean Report.
Dominica's opposition parties look to form a coalition government after the government's narrow defeat last night. Church leaders in Trinidad and Tobago enter the standoff between the president and the prime minister. And should Merle Naughty run with a drug charge hanging over her head? I'm Maureen Gordon, and this is BBC Caribbean Report.
The government is not going to lose the elections, and so it is not appropriate for me to get involved in that rhetorical question. The people of this country have seen the work that the government has done, and we are satisfied that the people of this country are ready to renew the mandate.
Outgoing Prime Minister Edison James speaking just after calling a snap election earlier this month. In Monday's election, his United Workers Party could only win 9 of the 21 seats. The Dominica Labour Party won 10 and the Dominica Freedom Party 2. A government of the two opposition parties now appears likely. More on that in a moment. The Prime Minister-designate, Rosie Douglas, says he has both a domestic and regional agenda for his new government. Today, he was in closed-door sessions with top officials of his Labour Party, after which they were expected to meet with their counterparts from the Freedom Party to talk power sharing. Mr. Douglas says he's already thinking of holding an inquiry into alleged corruption by the outgoing administration. Earlier today, Debbie Ransom asked him whether DFP leader Charles Savrin was likely to be the Deputy Prime Minister as part of a coalition arrangement.
Well, long after the coalition government, clearly there'll be a place for Mr. Savrin, because he wants to sit by six. He wants to sit by, I understand, by 6 votes.
Is he likely to be Deputy Prime Minister?
In the next couple of hours, the recount begins, and the recount will reflect what is the real position. When that real position is established as final, then we remove an element of instability.
Now, what's your view, both as politician and political scientist, of why the DLP won 10 seats?
I think it's clearly not just, as I said, winning 10 seats. The level of popular vote, the increase in our vote across the country, indicates that there's a sea change in this country. So the factors that led to that, I think, is the fact that people were fed up with the government. They realized that what the criticisms we were making about corruption, about nepotism, about failure in the economy, no hope in the economy, all those reasons people felt they had to make a statement.
So what are your priorities as you take office?
My priorities really have to be the priorities of the people. That is to clean up shop. Having begun the process of cleaning up mess, whatever inquiries have to be conducted in terms of existing projects in the country, how we proceed from there, giving up our promise to the private sector that they will have an opportunity to participate as partners with us in rebuilding this country, and then moving to discuss with many of the foreign investors who want to invest in this country, meeting with the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Britain, and other significant countries, ready to see how we lay the basis as quickly as possible to get Dominica turned around from a position of hopelessness to a position of new hope. The Dominican people spoke really on behalf of the Caribbean people last night, and I would like to reflect that feeling and that sentiment which the people feel and which I myself feel. So our priority, first of all, is to move to clean up the mess and put policies in place to get our country moving again as a significant country in the Caribbean.
Rosie Douglas talking to Debbie Ransom. Dominicans could know by way of a public meeting this evening just what shape the new government will take. A short while ago, I asked Caribbean Report's Mikey Bruni whether a Labour-Freedom coalition remains the most likely outcome.
This remains the most likely outcome, given the announcement to the population before the elections, given the grounds on which they campaigned. The two parties said they accommodated each other. They were willing to work together to oust the United Workers Party government. Now that the first objective has been achieved, one would expect them to follow on with their promises to the population and form a government.
How close are they, do you think, to agreeing on the composition of the cabinet? Could Labour go it alone if they don't, with only 10 of the 21 seats?
If they don't agree, then the Labour Party can, in fact, form the government, because the constitution of Dominica provides that the president shall appoint a person who is likely to command the majority of elected members of the House as the prime minister. At the moment, Rosie Douglas has 10 members and he has the largest group. So he can be, in fact, appointed prime minister of Dominica. At the same time, by the same constitution, the leader of the opposition United Workers Party, Edison James, can be appointed leader of the opposition. In that scenario, Roosie Douglas would then be entitled to advise the president to appoint 5 senators, while Edison James can advise the president to appoint 4 senators.
But by all accounts, Mr. Douglas is acting and looking like the prime minister already. Surely this can't be reversed at this stage.
It can only be reversed if, for example, the Freedom Party elected members get together with the United Workers Party, or if Mr. James can pull out 1 or 2 members from the Labour Party to join with the United Workers Party. Both of these events are very unlikely.
Let's look at the position of Mr. Savarin. He is or could be a kingmaker in all this, yet his own position in his constituency is somewhat weakened by the fact that he was run so close.
That is the position. And not only that, but his party has lost popularity tremendously. It only got about 5,000 votes in the election yesterday, which represents a very, very small percentage. Two other parties between themselves got about 35,000 votes. So that Savarin's party itself is very unpopular with the population at the present moment. They won in 2 key constituencies where they have always won and really lost badly in all the other constituencies. So he is in the most precarious position when it comes to any possible arrangement of the formation of a government.
Mikey Bruni in Roseau. The interreligious organization of Trinidad and Tobago is to play a mediating role between the president and the prime minister. In a continuing impasse, President Robinson refuses to comply with the prime minister's request to revoke the appointment of 2 Tobago senators and appoint 2 others in their place. He says it threatens the union of Trinidad and Tobago. But constitution experts are pointing out that the president does not have a discretion in the appointment of government senators. Tony Fraser reports on the latest developments.
A representative team from the interreligious organization met Monday with President Robinson to find out what role they could play in bringing the head of state and the head of government to begin discussing their differences. And this morning, the team met with Prime Minister Basudeo Pandey. Sources told Caribbean reporters that President Robinson impressed on the religious leaders that he was totally committed to the interests of Tobago and was not about to drop those interests. In the meeting with the Prime Minister this morning, Mr. Pandey is said to have taken up a very legalistic position that the Constitution has to be obeyed, and he was not prepared to yield 1 inch on that ground. Moreover, Prime Minister Pandey is said to be gearing up to take the issue to several public meetings across the country to inform his constituents about the refusal of the President to follow his advice. Sources say President Robinson got back in touch with the interreligious body today and set down a condition for revoking the appointments. That condition is said to be that the Prime Minister must first meet with the Chief Secretary of the Tobago House of Assembly to decide on the new senators to be appointed. But Caribbean Report understands that the religious leaders will write to the President advising that he should first sign the letters removing the 2 Tobago senators. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Pandey has written to the President asking for a meeting on Thursday. Tony Fraser in Port of Spain for BBC Caribbean Report.
European officials are to meet with representatives of the Africa, Caribbean and Pacific group of countries tomorrow to finalize details of a successor agreement to the 4th Lomé Convention. The convention, a trade and aid package between the European Union and the ACP, expires this month. A post-Lomé accord is not just about extending or dropping existing trade and aid deals. It's also about persuading those outside the agreement that it should be allowed to exist in a world of increasingly free trade. Emma Joseph reports.
The Lomé Convention has grown from a 5-year package of $3.4 billion in trade and aid to the final $11.7 billion 10-year Lomé 4 agreement, which expires next month. It's become increasingly difficult to argue the case for keeping the convention going in its original form. Enter On Stage, the World Trade Organization, created to be the final arbiter of global trading deals. Many parts of the Lomé Convention were ripe for WTO criticism when it came into being. The most obvious section was Protocol 5, which allows traditional ACP banana-producing states access to their existing markets in Europe through duty-free deals. The Banana Protocol ended up at the center of a transatlantic trade war. It was in this environment that EU and ACP officials finalized their discussions over a post-Lomé agreement. EU and ACP ministers have virtually agreed to extend most of the existing convention arrangements when Lomé 4 runs out next month. But the real task at hand will be to get the waiver needed for the transitional period. Europe proposes that they'll move from Lomé trade to free trade by 2008. The idea is that the new trading arrangement will resemble the recent deals Europe signed with South Africa and South America. But that transition can only happen if the WTO agrees to an 8-year waiver. So, in truth, an agreement by European and ACP officials on a post-Lomé accord in Brussels this week will really just be another starting point.
That report was by Emma Joseph. And the European Union said today it was hopeful about agreeing on a new trade and aid deal this week with the ACP countries. The chief negotiator for the EU's Executive Commission, Philip Lowe, says both sides are on course towards concluding a final agreement. The ACP states want a 30-year agreement, but the EU prefers a 15-year-long commitment. The new arrangements must be compliant with World Trade Organization rules. Outstanding issues to be resolved in the final leg of the talks include immigration and improved market access. Jamaica's sugar workers have negotiated a sweet deal with the industry. They're to get a 5% pay rise this year and the next, and they'll also get new houses built for them. The deal means that it won't be the sort of strike that has crippled the sugar industry in the past. Up to 50,000 workers earn their income from the sugar industry, which in turn earns the country up to $100 million a year. Professor Trevor Munro of the University and Allied Workers Union, one of the sugar workers' unions, says the settlement was timely.
Had this agreement not been reached, the crop would have been in significant trouble. We need to recall that 2 years ago at the last negotiations, regrettably, there was a breakdown and indeed an industrial action which affected the entire industry.
But Dr. Munro admits that neither the workers nor the unions are completely satisfied.
We're not very happy, and the workers are not very happy with the level of the increase in respect of wages and other direct monetary items. This is below what we expected.
Trevor Munro of the University and Allied Workers Union. Finally, despite being under suspicion for drug use, Jamaica star athlete Merlin Otte has decided that she will run in the 60 and 200 meters event tomorrow at a track meet in Valencia in Spain. Some in athletics are describing Otte's participation as a joke. She had to withdraw from a meet in Germany at the weekend after a number of athletes threatened to withdraw if she competed. Technically, she can run, but her participation highlights a gray area for athletes who've tested positive but who've not had an IAAF pronouncement on their innocence or guilt. I've been speaking with the BBC's athletics correspondent, Mike Costello, and I asked him, where does this leave the organisers of the Valencia race meeting?
Well, it leaves them in a bit of a quandary because, as the head of the meeting organisers committee said, there's nothing technically they can do because she isn't banned. The inquiry into her case is still pending. We've heard earlier this week that Limpha Christie, who tested positive for the same drug last year, and another British athlete, Dougie Walker, will hear their cases in April. It's expected that Merlin Otte will hear her case very soon after that. Certainly they will hear the case before the summer season outdoors begins. But until then, if Merlin Otte wants to run, then she's free to run.
But isn't it the convention that she should withdraw from the race until she clears her name?
That's usually what happens. And usually athletes find it too uncomfortable to race when they've got a shadow hovering, a drugs spectre hovering around them. They don't feel comfortable enough. But perhaps Merlin Otte is of such strong mental fortitude that she can push this aside. And many athletes, in particular sprinters, can do this. That's what they have to do when they race in these races over 60 metres indoors and 100 metres outdoors. They think only of themselves. They got where they are by being among the most selfish people on the planet.
Is there also the thought that I'm innocent of these charges and why shouldn't I be here?
That's the other view, you see. If they pull out of races once they've been invited, then that sends a message to the athletics authorities and to the public in general that maybe they feel themselves that they are guilty and therefore don't deserve to be running.
Isn't she in fact, though, defying the IAAF?
Not technically, because they haven't suspended her yet. They have still to investigate the findings of the committee and the laboratory that found her test to be positive in Switzerland last year.
But they did expect that she wouldn't have been there for this. She wouldn't have shown up for this meeting.
Absolutely. And usually that's the case.
Mike Costello ending BBC Caribbean Report. Our morning editions are at 11:05 and 12:10 GMT. This is Oren Gordon saying goodbye from London.